Welcome to Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Wett. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
Thank you. It's good to have you here, and good to talk about church history again. And I think I'm just going to start off with this today because you handed this to me, and I'm very excited about it. Father has developed I'm going to change my mind. I'm going to let you tell about it, and then I'll tell you people how we can get a hold of it.
Good. Well, I'm quite excited about it, too, actually. It's a Reformation chronology, and it basically goes from Wittenberg with Luther and the 95 Theses all the way up to the closing of the Council of Trent. And one of the things I realized as I was looking and preparing these programs is that we're dealing with 47 years of some of the most complex history. I mean, everything's going on at once. And what we have a tendency to do is, when we look at this period of time, historians have a tendency to do the Protestant side first, and then the Catholic side after. They call that, usually they call it the Catholic Reformation or the Counter-Reformation. But the fact of the matter is that the Catholic Reformation was underway before the Protestant Reformation began. We've already talked about that. It was going on during the Protestant Reformation, and it continued on after the Protestant Reformation. So these 47 years are pretty complex. And so what I did was, I using the theme we've been doing all throughout these sets of programs, is I've taken movements that are radial, that is to say, movements that are united to Rome and bringing the church together. And I had one column, and all the events that take place that are radial, that bring us together. And then the second column is tangential. That is to say, all those movements within the church that take people away from the center, out of the church, and splinter the church. And then over on the far right side, I had all the events that are secular. They don't necessarily have anything to do with religious history. A lot of it's military history, actually. And yet they impact on what's going on in the religious history of the period. So anyway, there's the three columns, and you have dates that run, as you can see, from 1517 up to 1563. This is not comprehensive. It's not everything that happened, but it's pretty much of the most important things that have happened during that 47 years. And you'll see that there is considerable overlap of things happening. I found that to be a much clearer way of looking at this era rather than doing the old standard Protestant Reformation, Catholic Counter-Reformation kind of a thing, because it's not accurate. That the old way of teaching it is not really accurate as to what happened. You know, looking at it, I think there are two or three lessons for us before we hop into the lesson for today. And one of the lessons is that you can see there's a whole lot of things going on in the tangential column, a lot of action. And if you look at it one after another, what you're going to see is Christendom falling apart or being torn apart. This is not a reformation of the church. What it is instead is a splintering of the church. Got a wonderful book with me I brought in. Just would recommend it to anybody who has a lot of time and loves reading. This is by Warren Carroll, the former president of Christendom College, the founder of Christendom, who gave up the administrative post a number of years ago to go back to the classroom. I'm very thankful he did, and to writing. And he's now finished his fourth volume in the history of Christendom. This particular volume is talking about the Reformation era, and he titles it The Cleaving of Christendom, and that's really what happened. Anyone who wants a lot of information, and this book is like 750 pages long, it wants a lot of information of what was going on in this era. Warren Carroll is excellent and uses a lot of really solid sources, like Ludwig von Pastor's History of the Popes and a number of others. But there you have, and that. So that's one observation you could have, is that there is a lot going on in the tangential column. In the radial column, that is to say, the papal column, the Roman column, you don't find as much going on, especially at the beginning, and then toward the end, it picks up. And you have to ask the question, why? And a lot of times you have this impression that the popes are kind of sitting on their duff. Well, there is a succession of popes. A number of popes don't live a long time, and so they're not really able to reform the church. A number of them came in to reform the church and then died relatively young. Pope Adrian is an example of that. Dutchman no sooner gets down to Rome, begins reforming the church, and then dies. So that's part of it. But I think there's something even more important. And what it is this. The Catholic Church understood perfectly well that to bring about a true reformation of the church, they needed a council. They learned that, remember, back in the papal schism, just a century or so ago. And they knew that they had to have a council to do this. Now, to have a council, you need two things. And they discovered this also through the Council of Constance. Number one, you have to have a legitimate pope call a legitimate council. They learned that lesson with that, you know, the fake Council of Pisa and the fake popes and, you know, all of those, the anti-popes. The second thing they learned that they needed was an emperor who could support that council. Right. Remember that the Emperor Sigismund was that leader. Now, what we have now is Charles V, and we're going to take a little look at Charles V later on. This is a man that had too much on his plate. That's all there was to it. But the other thing is this. For Charles V, in order to bring about the support that the Pope needed to have a council, he needed some things too. And the first thing he needed was peace. He needed peace. And there were two people who were going to make sure that he did not get it. And one of those was the King of France, Francis I. Mm-hmm. And we'll be seeing quite a bit about him. This guy is a real fly in the ointment. And then the other is the Ottoman Turkish leader, Suleiman the Magnificent. If you look over on that secular column, I mean, he is on the move. The Turks take Cairo in 1517, the same year as the 95 Theses. Later on, then he becomes the leader in 1520. Then you have Belgrade falling, Rhodes falling, Hungary being attacked, Vienna itself being attacked. You know, there are just it's a horrible attack, both by sea and by land, against the Christian Europe, and it's Charles V that has to defend Europe. In order to do that, he needs troops.
Right.
And that means that he needs including German Protestant troops. And that's why he goes so light on Lutherans.
Okay.
Well, we'll see all of this as it plays out. But as I say, it's a very complex history, those 47 years. So I thought that chronology would be something that would be helpful, keeping all this together.
Well, I can see it definitely will be helpful. And I'd like to offer, and Father has made this offer, that anybody who would like a copy of this, that they may send. We think what will work best is if you send a self-addressed envelope to the radio station. Her address is 3515 Hampton, St. Louis, 63139. And just mark on there that you want a copy of the chronology from Father Witt. And I'll see that gets to you, because it really will be especially helpful in talking with these through these programs. But I think in your own study and just looking at it alone is very interesting, and seeing how they fit together, I think, really makes a big difference.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that. Thank you for doing that for me.
Certainly. Okay. Well, last time we were together, we began to see the cleaving of Christianity, Christendom. We saw already that Luther had taken a large number of mainly Germans out of the Catholic Church. And so you begin having the building of a Lutheran Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, almost immediately, Zwingli, another priest, a dropout priest who farms his own group and spends a lot of time arguing with Luther. You have another man in the middle who is trying to bring the two together unsuccessfully. He also is a former priest, a former Dominican, Martin Bucer, from the University of Strasbourg. And so he's sort of like in the middle. You have these gatherings, these colloquies, like the Marburg colloquy, trying to bring the Protestant side together to offer some kind of an alternative to the Catholic Church. They can't do it because their proposition is itself toward a tangential movement, an individual movement. And so you have people like Munzer, Thomas Munzer, who himself is a farmer priest also. There's a lot of farmer priests in this group. And he goes way over into, he becomes a leader of the Anabaptists, and they go off and really do some radical things, especially when they take over the very Catholic city of Münster, Münster in northern Germany, and just institute this this incredible Protestant communist city state that lasted 1 year and did horrible havoc to everything. So all of this is taking place, and then we'll see John Calvin coming in and introducing a whole new series of changes on the tangential or the Protestant side. But before we do that, I want to go back over and spend a little time in England.
Okay,
here's the situation in a Catholic country in which we have a Catholic king who has defended the faith, in fact, received special honor from the Pope as being a defender of the faith. And we're going to see how he ends up taking the church once again and ruining a beautiful Christendom in England, one of those great centers of Catholic faith, and is going to take England away from the church, and but at the same time try to do it in such a way that he is going to think that he is keeping the Catholic Church in England. Well, we'll see how that happens and how that's not the case. But I thought it would be better for us to spend some time in England and then get back over into Switzerland and look at John Calvin.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think the key here to keep in mind is that the Tudor family is very concerned right from the get-go about stability in England itself and also a role to play in foreign affairs in Europe itself in a larger sense. One of the things to always keep in mind is that the Tudors are so aware that England has just gone through a terrible civil war. Earlier, remember the horrible Hundred Years' War that wore on, that no sooner came to an end, and the English went out after each other in what's known as the War of the Roses, because the two families that were fighting over the royal throne had a red rose and a white rose as their emblems. In the end, it was a terrible slaughter, and finally then the Tudor family picks up the pieces. And Henry VII, the father of Henry VIII, is going to try to stabilize the country. And so this means that the highest in their mind is going to be stability and making sure there's a male heir. This becomes really important to the Tudors, that there's a male heir to take over in each generation so that a new civil war doesn't break out, which would absolutely destroy England.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so he does this by establishing a peaceful and a prosperous England and working closely with the most powerful family in all of Europe, the Habsburgs.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yeah. And so he makes arrangements to marry off his eldest son to a Habsburg princess, Catherine of Aragon.
Okay.
Yeah. The Habsburgs were really good at using marriages and bringing about alliances. And so Catherine was available, and they shipped her on over to England, and she was married then to, I believe his name was Arthur. And then what happened was that Arthur died. He died almost immediately after the wedding itself.
Oh, my gosh.
There is great question and doubt as to whether the marriage had ever been consummated.
Oh.
This becomes very important later on, because if the marriage had not been consummated, then the marriage itself is open to question
right
its legitimacy and its validity. And so what happens is that with the death of her groom, so shortly after the wedding, Catherine then decides that she's going to pack up and go back to Spain and do what she'd really want to do, which would be to spend the rest of her life in a nunnery.
Uh-huh.
You know. Well, Henry VII had other ideas. He was not real interested. I mean, you know, he had worked very hard to bring about this alliance between the Tudors and the Habsburgs, and he did not want to see that disrupted. And so he's on his deathbed, and he prevails to his younger son to marry Catherine of Aragon before she could pack up all the jewels and other goodies she had brought and take him back to Spain. Well, Henry is younger than Catherine. He is a restless, wild guy that just wants to have a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, this was his father's death wish.
Right.
And so Henry VIII, Henry Jr., agreed to do this. And so he was then married to Catherine of Aragon.
Wow.
Okay.
Do we know how much age difference is there?
I don't.
Okay.
I'd have
okay.
to look it up.
Oh, yeah. That's fine.
It's a couple years, but nonetheless, he found himself being tied down to an older woman who for a fun evening would be to spend it in a chapel saying rosaries,
uh-huh.
and that was not Henry VIII's idea of a fun evening.
Right.
Okay. Anyhow. So he does this, and this gives him at least temporarily some really big and powerful friends.
Mm-hmm.
There's a war going on at the time. It's a group, it's an alliance called the Holy League against France. And so now that he's part of the family,
uh-huh.
He's opened now to being able to join the Holy League against France. And so there's big hitters like Pope Julius II. Is in this league, the Emperor Maximilian, King Ferdinand of Castile, you know, his father-in-law, and so he's hobnobbing with the mm-hmm. with the important people. However, he doesn't contribute much to the war, and the other leaders turned around and sued for peace, brought about a peace treaty, and forgot to mention him.
Oh,
so it was kind of embarrassing. He was kind of left out. Also, at the imperial court, there was big question. This was at the time in which Maximilian was quite elderly,
mm-hmm.
and everyone was very concerned about who would become the next emperor. And Henry sided with his nephew, Charles, the Duke of Burgundy, who would eventually become Charles I of Spain, Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire.
Okay.
And so he once again he looked at this as being a good alliance because Charles, some of his realm also includes the Low Countries, which are right across the English Channel from Great Britain. It's a big wool area. There's a lot of commerce going on. They're very strategic ports. England produces a lot of wool.
Mm-hmm.
The Low Countries are doing lots of textile, and so it's a great opportunity for commerce back and forth. The whole works. And so in the midst of all of this, Henry says to Charles, gives word to Charles, says, you know, Pope's not going to live forever. Would you support an English bishop as the next pope? And Charles's response back is something like, well, it's a possibility. And he said, well, how about Cardinal Wolsey? And Charles's reply was not in my life, or something along those lines, you know. And so once he was out of luck, so Henry decides to play two ends against the middle.
Okay.
And what he does is he contacts the King of France. This is the young Francis I, who is in many ways the French mirror image of Henry. Here's a guy who is athletic, loves hunting, loves contact sports. He also loves wenching, one mm-hmm. of his contact sports, and so they had a lot in common. And so he made arrangements in 1520 to have a meeting between Henry VIII and Francis I. And in the process, there was a big tournament, and they got on quite well, at least until somebody mentioned that Francis was a world-class wrestler.
Uh-oh.
And Henry said, well, you know, I'm no slouch myself at it. And the two of them, it's a terrible mistake, they had a royal wrestling match between the two of them. And, of course, in a wrestling match, only one can win.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry VIII got pinned.
Mm-hmm.
And he, once again, he was really, his ego was bruised really badly. And, of course, Francis rubbed it in, too, which was not the best thing to do. The next year, another war broke out between France and the Habsburgs. And once again, Henry found himself joining up with Charles as a junior partner. And once again, he brought up Cardinal Wolsey as a possible pope. And once again, Charles said, no way. And finally, he gives up on it. So he's really caught between a rock and a hard spot. His foreign policy is kind of a shambles, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so... anyway, in the midst of all of this stuff going on, and in the midst of all of his hunting trips and his carousings and all this kind of things, the fact of the matter is that he over a number of years fell out of love with Catherine of Aragon, if he had ever been in love with her to begin with. He had even convinced Pope Julius II to send a letter to Catherine telling her, this is the Pope, writing to the Queen of England saying, please do not pray so much. You're taking yourself away from another important sacrament, matrimony, which you need to, you know, pay more attention to your husband. Well, as if that would make any difference, because by this time, Henry was absolutely enamored with a young English thing by the name of Anne Boleyn.
Okay.
Now, I have heard that, and at least one historian has said that part of the attraction for Anne, there were a couple things that really attracted Henry to Anne, but one of the attractions was evidently on one hand she had a sixth finger.
Okay, that was his attraction. Okay.
Well, it's rare.
It's rare, yeah.
Probably the more important thing. I don't know whether that's actually true or not. It is quite a rare phenomenon. But the other thing that is even more enticing, undoubtedly, that made her all the more attractive to the king was she would not let him touch her.
Oh, yeah.
And he had his way with anybody and anything, but Anne would not let him touch her. And it drove him crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And she constantly said, I can't do this because you're married. But if you weren't married, then that opens up a whole new kettle of fish. Now, Henry has that going on.
Right.
He also has the dynastic thing going on. He's been married to Catherine of Aragon over 20 years.
Oh.
They have had one child, and that is a girl,
okay.
Mary Jr., Mary
That's
Tudor.
That's right, okay.
And in the midst of all of this, somebody comes to the king and says, do you know that in the Bible, you broke a very important commandment, and you're being cursed. That's why you don't have any male heirs. Oh, really? Show me. And they went to Leviticus 20:21, and the quote from Leviticus 20:21 is this: and if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He hath uncovered his brother's nakedness; they shall be childless. Based upon that, all of a sudden, Henry, the defender of the faith,
oh, yes.
Started having some real scriptural doubts about his marriage. The fact of the matter is that he knew that he could produce children. After all, you know, this guy is so testosterone full, it's not even funny. Not only did he produce a child of a girl, but then she doesn't count. You know, the
right.
English thought that only a man could run England. Strangely enough, the two most important monarchs in English history are women.
Right.
You know, Elizabeth I and Victoria. But he also knew that he could produce a son, because he had a son, a young boy by the name of Fitzroy, who was illegitimate and therefore unable to come to the throne. So by now, they've been married 24 years. And with this, Henry then writes to the Pope and says, my Lord, you wouldn't guess what? I just discovered that I had this terrible sin, and that's why I'm childless, and this marriage was not a marriage at all, and so we need to have an annulment. And this was in around 1529, and certainly the Habsburgs had some pretty good lawyers. They pulled together, and of course Cardinal Wolsey was given the job of leading up the annulment, and so they entered into the courts. This went on for 5 months.
Okay.
Now you can imagine how Henry is feeling. This man is just, like I say, testosterone driven. At the same time, he's having no relations with his wife, and at the same time, his supposed mistress won't have any relations with him either. So he is just going crazy after 5 months of testimonies and hearings. And at the very end, when it comes to the end, finally, the Pope turns around and says, well, we can't decide this in England. It has to be decided in Rome. And when you come to Rome, you have to argue the briefs all over again. Oh, Henry went crazy. Start over again. It was going to, he simply said it was not going to happen. The court, the case would be tried in a British court. That he just simply rules that. Turns around and fires Cardinal Wolsey.
Oh, okay.
And it's at this point that he needs some window dressing because he's looking pretty bad, you know, in everybody's eyes. And so he brings in as his prime minister one of the greatest humanists of all times, one of the greatest humanists, Christian humanists of certainly that age, of that Renaissance period, and we're talking about Thomas More.
Thomas More, okay.
You know, Thomas More, the friend of Vives over at the imperial court, Thomas More, the friend of Desiderius Erasmus, one of the most respected men in all of England, one of the most respected men in all of Europe. And More agrees to take the position. What you have then is two other individuals who are going to be working closer to the monarchy to bring about the divorce. With More, he's not working for the divorce. That's all there is to it.
Right.
And Henry realizes very early on that he has the wrong man if he thought he was going to get somebody to come over on his side. On the other hand, he has Thomas Cranmer working for him. He was from the University of Cambridge. He advocates that the university, either Oxford or Cambridge or the two, study the question of the marriage and the divorce and that they make a ruling on it. Henry's quite happy with that. And then the other is Thomas Cromwell, who is the former secretary of Wolsey and is someone who knows the lay of the land legally for the divorce.
Okay.
But it's going to be a very difficult thing to prove because, as I said before, the original marriage that Catherine had with
With
his brother was probably not consummated. It couldn't be proven one way or the other. You know, and then even just Mary, I mean, it's a real stretch of the imagination that Leviticus would be saying that a deceased brother was still in force. You know? Well, anyhow, what happens is that there are a whole series of acts that are passed in Parliament using a lot of strong-arm tactics by Cranmer and Cromwell. And Henry VIII really pressing these. The first one, and it's very clever the way they're set up, too. The first act was called the Act of Praemunire. And what this did was it forbade any papal bulls, any letters from the Pope being published in Great Britain.
Okay.
So it took away the opportunity for the Pope to speak publicly, directly to the people of England. Dictators do this quite often, and we found even in the 20th century, Nazi Germany, the Pope was not free to communicate with the people, the Catholics of Germany.
Right.
Things had to be smuggled back and forth. So this was typical, and of course, certainly communist Russia was another example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right after that, another act was passed called the Act of Annates. And what that did was it would allow no English money to be donated to the church and leave England any money donated to the church would stay in England itself. Nothing could be sent. So Peter's pence mm-hmm. was now cut off.
Okay.
And remember that this is one of the great Catholic centers, England.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, you go back to the Middle Ages, and England was technically a fiefdom of Pope Innocent III. You know, after the signing of the Magna Carta and after John I and all this, it actually became a fiefdom of the Pope. It was considered to be, among the English people, to be a holy country. When you look at the great background of Bede, Venerable mm-hmm. Bede, and Augustine of Canterbury and Edward mm-hmm. and all of these great saints, English saints. And here, now, this has happened. It's quite shocking. But Henry wasn't finished. He had another act passed shortly after called the Act of Uniformity. This was a very controversial act because it said that the head of the church in England would be recognized as the king. So he would have church authority, ecclesiastical authority, as well as legal secular authority in England. Now, there are examples of something similar to this. In France, sometimes you have a Gallican Catholic church that is paying more attention to the king than to the Pope. We mm-hmm. saw that, even during the Avignon Papacy and at different times in French history. There are times when in Germany, the emperor had more influence in church affairs than in church. So this is extraordinary. But it's not unheard of.
Okay.
Right? But the fact that it's passed in Parliament,
mm-hmm.
that makes it all the more. And then finally, the last act, which is what he was driving at to begin with, is the Act of Succession. And what that did was it basically broke the question of the divorce. He had been secretly married to Anne already.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And of course, as head of the church in England, he granted himself the divorce.
Uh-huh.
That's a no-brainer.
Uh-huh.
and so then in the Act of Succession, it recognizes that the offspring of his new bride, Anne Boleyn, would be the legitimate heir, assuming, of course, that it'll be a boy.
Right.
Of course. Anne had
promised. To be.
Yes, that's right. Well, go ahead.
What effect did Henry's manipulation of the Parliament during the divorce cause the Parliament's power? Did they grow? What happened?
I'm sorry?
They had to have grown.
Yes. Yes, they really did. And constitutional historians who look at English history and the development of the English Constitution, the unwritten Constitution, look to this as a big leap forward in parliamentary power. Because now Parliament's going to have a long way to go, a couple mm-hmm. more hundred years before it really has that kind of clout. And they'll go through a terrible civil war a generation later, which will be both religious and constitutional. But what you find now is for the first time a monarch going to the Parliament and saying, I need you to pass this act.
Mm-hmm.
The very term, I need you,
mm-hmm.
means something.
Right.
Since the Middle Ages, and certainly the document that was signed on the fields of Runnymede in 1066, the Magna Carta, you have the beginnings of a sense of a balanced government, government imbalances. But really now, these four acts, and the fact that the king goes to Parliament and gets these acts passed, really sets Parliament up. What you'll see later on is that his successors will also go back to Parliament, whether it be Edward, who does succeed him, Mary Tudor goes mm-hmm. back to Parliament, Elizabeth goes back to Parliament. So Parliament it becomes really the forum for civil action, legal action within England.
And
this, I think it's underestimated so often that these four acts had been done by Parliament and not by royal decree.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So really, this was the first big move of a parliament in in government.
Yeah, really. And certainly much more than anything else you're going to find on the continent. You'll find diets like in Germany that are going to be important, and you'll have in France, they very seldom meet, called the constitutional convention called the Estates General, meets every so many centuries when there's a national crisis. In Spain, you do have the Cortes there, but none of these bodies really have are going to be given the significance that the Parliament in England is going to be given.
All right.
It's a fascinating side issue that's happening too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Besides just the church history, it's parliamentary history.
Right.
Is also being made.
The government. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, one group of people was watched very carefully concerning this act of uniformity.
Okay.
That's going to be the bishops.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can the bishops possibly, they're in union with the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
How can they possibly turn around and say, well, it's the king who actually calls the shots in the church in England? And so they met in 1531. The bishops met, and they looked this thing over, and they thought, what are we going to do? And what they did was they said that they would recognize the act of uniformity, that they would recognize the legitimate leadership of the king of the church in England, quote, as far as the laws of Christ permit,
okay.
Unquote.
Okay.
Well, you can imagine Henry is probably asking the same question that all of us are asking right now. What does that mean?
Exactly.
So they wiggled out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But they could only wiggle so far.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, what happened was, he goes back to Parliament again and gets another act called the Treason Act. And this act was very, very clear. You have to choose. Now, by this time, Elizabeth has already been born. In fact, Anne was pregnant at their wedding.
Okay.
And they had to choose. Now, who is the legitimate successor? Is it going to be Mary or is it going to be Elizabeth? And if you answer that wrong, you'll lose your head. And it was based upon this that you have then the arrests that take place, the high-profile arrests. First of all, the Bishop John Fisher is brought into the Tower of London. He is badly abused, and then is told that if he that they just wanted an answer, and they let him go. And he answered wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of letting him go, they used that answer in a trial. And he was found guilty and was had his head chopped off.
Right.
Shortly after that, Thomas More also was brought in. We're going to talk more about Thomas More a little bit later on. But he also was arrested, sent to the Tower of London, and then was also executed. And as I say later on, when we start looking at this incredible bevy of saints that comes up in the latter part of this 47 years, I want to say something about Thomas More. He dies in 1535, right in the middle of all the confusion.
So the movie Man for All Seasons, was that historically accurate?
Yeah, that was a great film.
Oh,
1966, I think it was.
Okay.
And I just saw it again a couple of weeks ago, and I got the DVD and saw it. It really is. I loved it from an historical point of view. It's accurate.
It is.
Okay. And it also is a portrayal of a man who is absolutely incredible. Here is a rock in the midst of a sea of uncertainty.
Right.
This man knew right from wrong, right from the very beginning. He was also bright. You know, he was also a lawyer, well-trained, and he knew not to put his head in the noose unless he absolutely had to. But after the Treason Act, he knew that the game was up.
It was time.
It was time. And he went to his death as honorably as can be.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in his correspondences, and I think with Erasmus, who died just a year after his death,
right.
They used to always sign at the bottom. They'd say, "Pray for me as I for thee, that we merrily meet in heaven." You know? So just a magnificent man. And in a great film, I'd really recommend it.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
It's at this point that that Cranmer and Cromwell come up with an idea for making money for the king. King's always interested in money. They turn around to him and they say, well, you're the head of the church in England, and there are problems in part of your church. And he goes, oh, really? Like where? And he goes, the monasteries. Monasteries have huge land holdings. They've got cattle, they've got sheep, they've got grain, the whole works, to support these monasteries. They've been around for centuries, breweries, they've been around for centuries, and the monks support their effort through ora et labora, right, through their prayers and through their labors, and they just, the fact of the matter is, they're some of the best laborers, and maybe it's the motivation, but they do some of the best work in Europe, and so these are real plums for them to grab. And what happens is that in 1536, they set up a commission announcing that there are abuses taking place in some of the little monasteries, and they wanted to investigate them. So they get this investigation going. What they did was they went around to the little tiny monasteries, and they came up with these reports. These are fabricated. Reports about all kinds of sexual abuse taking place, promiscuity, the whole works. And what happens then is that the king says, well, we can't have this. And they closed the monasteries. They suppressed the monasteries. They gave the monks the opportunity to either leave or to receive a small pension for the rest of their lives, a little tiny portion of what the monastery was actually worth. And so those monks ended up doing that. The large, really famous monasteries watched this with horror. And sure enough, a couple months later, in come the commissions. They have the same findings. They're all trumped up. All the work that's been done, historians studying the history of the suppression of the monasteries in England, will show you that it's just a land grab is what it is. But the big monasteries also succumb to this. And as a result, there's lots of money that comes into the treasury. And also a lot of the early supporters of the king now receive a receive some of this land as gifts for being loyal to the king and tying them, of course, all the closer to Henry VIII. One of those is Ambleforth Abbey, which is familiar to us St. Louisans because it's the it's tied so closely with the abbey, the former priory in West St. Louis County. And a number of years ago, I met a British historian at a conference in Memphis, and we were talking, and he found out I was from St. Louis, and he mentioned about the priory in St. Louis and mentioned that he had been, his son had gone to the school at Ambleforth. And he mentioned, did you know that we're mentioned in a fairy tale or in a rhyme? And I said, a child's rhyme. And I said, no. And he said, yeah. I said, Little Jack Horner. And I said, what? And he said, Little Jack Horner. Jack Horner was actually a nobleman who had done favors for the King of England, Henry VIII. And as a result of that, his family received Ambleforth Abbey as this gift from the king. And so the little thing goes in, Little Jack Horner sat in the corner, and remember that he sticks his thumb in the pie and he pulls out a plum. Well, the plum is the abbey.
Okay.
And that's where that little story came from. It's kind of fascinating.
Hmm.
Well, the same year that Henry got all this wealth, he also fell out of love with Anne Boleyn. And she wasn't producing any male heirs, and she wasn't as exciting as she used to be. And so there were some charges made. We're not really sure whether they were correct or not. That might well have been. I think she was a little promiscuous, too. But the long and short of it was that two gentlemen of the court were tortured, and they admitted that she was having an affair with two musicians from the court, who were showing the racks and the torture instruments, and these musicians began to sing and told the king whatever he wanted. And the long and short of it was that Anne Boleyn was then taken out and executed, had her head chopped off for treason to the king. The very same day of the execution of Anne Boleyn, the marriage license was signed between Henry VIII and Lady Jane Seymour.
Quick relationship.
Yep, yep. There, he does have a son. Little Edward is born, but Jane dies in birth complications. So he now has his son, but at the same time, he's now a widow twice over and a divorcee on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, he then turns around, decides it's time to do a Habsburg trick and marry for diplomacy's sake.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so he sends over to Europe Thomas Cromwell, and he's to find a suitable wife for Henry, the King of England. And what he does is he thinks that this would be a great opportunity. Thomas Cromwell comes up with the idea of bringing together two powerful families, the Tudor family in England, and then another family, the Cleves family. It's a German family that has lots of Protestant connections.
Uh-huh.
And is involved with a league that has been that's setting itself up against the emperor and has a lot of money. And so the Cleves look like a good family to ally with. And so they happen to have a daughter available, Anne. Okay. Now, what happens is that Thomas Cromwell doesn't look into the details, but he has Hans Holbein, the great artist of the age, go to the Cleves and do a portrait of Anne of Cleves. This portrait is then sent over to England. And Henry goes, whoa, yeah, she's beautiful, yeah. Okay, so everything's arranged. Anne of Cleves arrives in England. Henry leaves London and goes down to meet her. She is one of the ugliest human beings in Europe, with the possible exception of Catherine von Bora. And Henry went ballistic. It was a very brief wedding. Henry left almost immediately afterwards, leaving Anne to slowly make her way to London. Thomas Cromwell was arrested shortly after and was executed on July 28th of 1540.
Oh.
He had been charged with treason. This is the man who had manipulated the death of Thomas More, of John
right.
Fisher, of countless others. He's the one that had orchestrated the confiscation of the monasteries, had given 11 of the best ones to his nephews. He had orchestrated the break with Rome. He is the great uncle of another Cromwell we'll hear later on, Oliver Cromwell.
Mm-hmm.
He's the great uncle of this guy. And now he finds himself being handed over to the executioner by the king that he had served so well all throughout his life.
Who had taken care of so many other women already.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And at least some historians argue that at the very end of this, he had a scaffold conversion and came back to the faith at the time of his death. I'm not so sure about that, whether that actually happened, but I have no doubt that it's a possibility.
Yeah, I would think it possibly could. It'd make you question everything that you've just been doing.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. I remember taking a trip one time within easy driving range of St. Louis out to Herman, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And in Herman, they have taken the grade school there and converted it into a museum. And there was a lot of publication in Herman. A lot of Germans had come over to the United States and had settled in Herman, and it was sort of an intellectual haven of secularists and atheists.
Okay.
Not exactly the kind of Germans that we think of here in St. Louis,
uh-huh.
who are mainly rather conservative Lutherans or Catholics, but there are a lot of atheists there, and a lot of their publications are right there for you to read, and boy, they just attack Christianity, attack immortality, attack, all the basic tenets of the church. And then if you go, if you remember their names, and then you go up on the top of the hill, there's the old cemetery. And you go up there, and the same people that had written all these things in books and magazines and newspapers are now buried at the top of the hill, and they all have things like, may you rest in Christ.
Ah.
May the angels take you to heaven, all this kind of stuff. And you go, I wonder, where the conversion was. But I think Thomas Cromwell might well have looked into the jaws of eternity and mm-hmm. thought that he was ill-equipped for the journey mm-hmm. and might have converted. Well, anyway, Henry didn't convert. Henry divorced Anne of Cleves, which he was able to do very easily because, after all, the divorce was granted by the head of the church in England, Henry, and then turned around right away after that and married Catherine Howard. And this is, she's an English woman, but she also comes from one of the oldest and most respected families in all of England. It's part of the Plantagenet line. It goes all the way back to William the Conqueror. And so, and also she is an incredibly beautiful woman. So I guess after Anne of Cleves, he wanted to
check that out a little further.
But at the same time, Catherine recognized that she was far too beautiful to be wasted on a middle-aged, fat old king. And so she had multiple affairs, and it was right under Henry's nose. Everybody in England knew it, mm-hmm. you know, and Henry knew it too, and he was insulted. And finally, within a year, 1541, he had her executed.
Mm-hmm.
For treason. So now he's a widow once again. In 1543, he marries Catherine Parr, who is no stranger to marriage. She is a widow two times over herself. And 2 years later, in 1547, Henry died. He was worn out. He was incredibly fat, just obese, pathetic, and had a very, very bad case of syphilis. Mm. And with all of that, his life comes to an end. When he died, nobody was upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has been rehabilitated in history. We see him now as this happy rogue of a character and all this, but the fact of the matter is that he was a tyrant, and he was mean, and he was ugly, and he was promiscuous,
mm-hmm.
and everybody in England knew it. And it took another several centuries. It wasn't until the 19th century that the English started treating him differently. And over here in the United States, we've got this silly love affair with Henry VIII. We even have restaurants and stuff in his honor and all that. It's just you don't know anything about
it. Well, so this is a time when there really is not divorce and remarriage. What
Very
drove right. him through all that?
Sexual promiscuity.
Just
all I can say. And it is, you're right, it is very rare to have divorces and remarriages and that in this century. There are a couple cases. A little bit later on, we'll take a look at Philip of Hesse, who did not divorce his wife, but rather married twice. So he was a bigamist.
Uh-huh,
you know.
Uh-huh.
That's rare, too. And when it became public, it was a terrible embarrassment, especially for Luther and Melanchthon, because they had condoned the second marriage, knowing that he would be married to more than one woman.
And I assume since being a king, he couldn't, and he had no sons then, he couldn't just be promiscuous on the side, because he wanted a son that
yeah,
would
that's right.
Would as bear
opposed,
the crown.
Yeah, that's right. As opposed to his French counterpart, Francis I, who was also promiscuous. He also had a very bad case of syphilis, but he was... He was monogamous, had one wife, and then an incredible string of mm-hmm. mistresses. You know, if you look at just the history of disease and the history of venereal disease in Europe, you know that something's going on. And I guess it's a good lesson for us in history to know that this generation is not any different than any others. In Europe was introduced to venereal diseases through the explorers, who had evidently brought it back from West Africa.
Hmm.
Usually the American Indians are accused of doing it, but it seems as though it was a skin disease among West Africans. It was not deadly for
mm-hmm.
them, but it was a skin disease. The Europeans introduced it, and you know that within one generation, venereal disease, syphilis, appeared from Lisbon all the way to Danzig in Poland, present-day Poland, within one generation.
Wow.
There's only one way to get this.
Mm-hmm.
So there must have been a lot of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And these kings were just, well, you got the money, mm-hmm. you got the power. And, yeah, so, and Henry's just one good example of that.
Right.
He was succeeded to the throne by his son, Edward,
okay.
taking the title Edward the Sixth. He's 10 years old. He will only live about 6 years himself. He's a very sickly boy. And basically, England was run by a committee of nobles during this period of time. The single most important thing they had to deal with, first of all, you try to keep the kid healthy, and you know, so he could grow up and have children and continue the line. That, of course, doesn't succeed. But the other priority that they had was regularizing the relationship between the church and mm-hmm. the government mm-hmm. in England. What is this going to look like? And remember that Henry VIII never allowed himself to understand himself as being a Protestant. He always argued that he was Catholic, and he was doing a Catholic thing by leading the church in England. Obviously, he was doing this for his own self-service. But he always maintained the illusion that the church in England was Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so he constantly used that term, church in England. It was simply the Catholic Church minus the Pope. On the other hand, the nobles recognized this as being a farce. And they begin moving, trying to figure out, it's going to be a Protestant church. But what kind of, by this time, you start asking the question, what flavor Protestant?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
there's already so many choices, right?
Yeah, right. Really. I mean, you could go ahead, and by this time, you could be Lutheran, although that seems like kind of a German thing mm-hmm. to do. Or you could be Zwingliite. But that seems really radical. Or you could be a Calvinist, and that's a possibility. In fact, there were a lot of English who were very attracted to that. You could be Anabaptist, but my goodness, they're just radical characters. And or even at this point, you could even be Unitarian,
mm-hmm.
because there's a Unitarian church that's been. So where are you going to be? You know, how is this going to work itself out? And over the time then that Edward is the king in England and king of England, and you have this committee of nobles running, they're going to argue back and forth, and they're going to try to become a Protestant church. Ultimately, what they'll be is a whole new flavor of Protestant, which will be then the Anglican Church, or the Church of England.
Right.
You begin seeing a switch now in language.
Uh-huh.
It always referred to this as the Church in England. Now, after Edward, and especially with Elizabeth, we'll see later on, now it really is the Church of England, and it is now its own brand of Protestantism.
All right. Well, Father, thank you very much, and we are at the end of the clock here, so
okay.
If you would close today for us.
Okay. Let us remember that we're in God's holy presence. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Heavenly Father, we ask you to shower your blessings upon us. And as the psalmist says, prosper the work of our hands, O Lord. Prosper the work of our hands. We pray this in the name of your Son and our Lord, Jesus Christ.
Amen.
The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you.